In the end, however, because this is getting a bit too dark, let me hasten to note that this vision of cataclysmic change is something that Žižek takes a touch less than earnestly. Addressing the notion that nothing will ever be the same again after September 11th, this is the sentence we started with, he expresses dissatisfaction with the notion, saying that it is just an empty gesture of saying something deep without really knowing what we want to say. What if, he asks, nothing apical happened after September 11, in fact? What if the shattering experience of September 11 ultimately served as a device which enables the hegemonic American ideology to go back to its basics, to reassert its basic ideological coordinates against the anti-globalist and other critical temptations? The lack of epochal change would be the result of an inability or reluctance then to bring a new criteriology to the fore. I'd like to build on this and ask whether in the humanities this is precisely what has happened. There is in fact no change, no new criteriology, because what has happened is a reassertion, a revision at best, of the humanities' basic ideological and conceptual coordinates. More of the same, then, with tokenistic gestures towards the acknowledgement of the events of September 11. Ultimately, even the notion of autoimmunity, striking and quotable though it is, does not take us much further than John Ashcroft's claim, the Attorney General, of course, in the US, that terrorists use America's freedom as a weapon against it. That's from Žižek, who quotes Ashcroft. And from theory, from philosophy, from the humanities, perhaps, we do expect a little bit better. Perhaps we want them to think for us just a little bit more reachingly, in a manner that is not over-dependent on the coining of terminology that is merely catchily apt. We certainly don't want them to reaffirm the old structures, to replay the arguments about the real and the virtual or the simulacral, or the pretty politics about otherness and orientalisms. I must confess, however, that reading what the theoretical humanities have had to say about September 11, well, doing that, I sometimes feel terribly jaded. Only Derrida's and Žižek's texts have seemed to me to attempt something really new, the former forced to change his old ambivalence against the temptations of apocalyptic thought, the latter moved to question against his instincts and in a manner too complicated to rehearse here, his leftist perspectives on the war on terror. Even Baudrillard and Virilio don't do as much. Baudrillard adjusting his familiar take on the vital illusion of the end, Virilio readapting his words on dramology. And Habermas? He admits that since September 11, he has often been asked whether or not the whole conception of his theory of communicative action has been brought into disrepute. His answer is that in international and in intercultural relations, the curbing power of the law plays a comparatively weak role, and that the desired transformation of a mentality happens through the improvement of living conditions, through a sensible relief from oppression and fear. If you find that inadequate, you are not alone. Boradori was similarly underwhelmed, pressing Habermas with the question of whether we should ask ourselves if the dialogue model suits the intercultural exchange at all, and whether it is always on our own terms that we swear to the solidarity between cultures. Nettled, Habermas responds, why should the hermeneutic model of understanding suddenly break down beyond the boundaries of our culture? He goes on, this model explains why attempts at understanding have a chance only under symmetrical conditions of mutual perspective taking, and that the critical power to put a stop to violence without reproducing it in circles of new violence can only dwell in the telos of mutual understanding and in our orientation towards that goal. So Habermas responds to September 11, what more Habermasianisms, I would say. There's a whole chapter in Žižek which sets out to explain why that isn't nearly enough, why it might even be delusive. But let me just say here that it reminds me of a little episode in Mian Martil's 2003 Booker Prize-winning Life of Pi. involving zoomorphism, that is, the phenomenon whereby just occasionally a predator will happily cohabit with its prey. Martel recounts the episode of a mouse suffered to live with a nest of vipers. This goes on for weeks. The vipers actually don't eat the mouse. Until a young viper, unaccustomed to the arrangement, snaps at the mouse, whereupon, the spell broken, an adult viper who had previously been tolerant promptly devours the rodent. Martel's next words are evocative. I'm sure even the adult viper, as it swallowed the mouse, must have felt somewhere in its undeveloped mind a twinge of regret, a feeling that something greater was just missed, an imaginative leap away from the lonely, crude reality of a reptile. It's a nice idea, but one is afraid that the mouse was always going to get eaten. At least one viper was always going to revert to type. One has to hope, of course, that this incapacity for the imaginative leap does not constrain the dialogue model of Habermas, that at the level of the human, contending sides can in fact engage in mutual perspective taking, away from the lonely, crude realities of terrorists and their would-be nemesis. But one rather fancies that with the aftermath of September 11, it is Jean-Francois Lyotard's model of the different, from his book of the same name, which remains the constraint. In a different, there exists a case of conflict between at least two parties that cannot be adequately resolved for lack of a rule of judgment applicable to both parties. Indeed, it is probably even starker than that, even darker, for here one cannot even know for sure who the other party in the different is, in September 11, that is, and what follows from it. As Zizek says, we are entering after September 11 a new era of paranoic warfare in which the greatest task will be to identify the enemy, with the terrorists themselves no longer eager to claim responsibility for their acts. Recall Madrid. In that scenario, with whom does one dialogue? If it is not even straightforwardly possible to get locked in a distinguishable different. If we have gone beyond the pale of even Lyotard's different, then I have to say that this is indeed a strange and a bad time for theory, when terror disarms even theory's bleakest conceptualizations of human discord. It is a time not even akin to that one, also immersed in terror with a capital T, of which the novelist wrote that it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Perhaps now, in our own time of terror, it is closer to being the worst of times, as Derrida anticipated. If that is so, it must be because in the striking phrase of Geoffrey Bennington, the time is now always ripe for the untimely. For the problem is that terrorism, which is untimely for its victims, for us, for the world, for theory, for philosophy, for everything that it supposedly changes, well, terrorism tends, on the other hand, to be punctual for its own terribly ripened appointments. Thank you.
Thank you, Vadim. Quite like the way Derrida refers to Bin Laden as Bin Laden. A 6'7" man with £500 million in the bank and an army behind him. That's
yes, the square quotes, with the emphasis on square.
Yeah, quite real.
Yes.
One thing that came to mind is that maybe we the expectation of that we have that theory should change in some way has to do with the fact that we like things to happen. Mm. I remember in 1999-2000, we all remember the supposed millennium bug, and the world was not going to be the same again after midnight on 2000. In fact, absolutely nothing happened. And of course, 9/11, we expected to change things in some way or another, but in my opinion, nothing much really has changed. except the way in which we talk about small and quite insignificant things, and the way in which we understand small and quite insignificant, banal, everyday happenings. For example, a couple of weeks ago, someone was eating a pastry, a croissant, in the subway in Brussels, and in so doing, some icing sugar dropped from the pastry on. And when the police found this icing sugar, the whole
it was anthrax.
Yeah, they thought it was anthrax, and the whole place was closed down for several hours, actually. So of course, September 11 has definitely changed these ways of seeing it. But I don't think it has changed. Changed theory. But of course, it does change the way in which we talk about. But it's a bit like God, really. Who doesn't change anything, has never changed anything, but of course the notion of God profoundly changes the way in which we look at the world and in which the way in which we understand the world. Now, oh yes, I have some, I cannot forget my private eye. Now, the private eye, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is a satirical magazine in Britain. It's very, very famous, very popular, satirical magazine in Britain. And the Private Eye has, since September 11, run a weekly, or fortnightly actually, because it's published fortnightly, section called War Balls, in which quotes referring to September 11 and how September 11 has changed the world are listed. For example, here we have. Now, these are quotes from actual magazines and what have you. After the tragedy of 11 September attacks, Jersey Seymour, that's a designer, I think, decided to design a seat which would give the world a great big hug and bring everybody together. The result was Muff Daddy, made from machine washable denim covers with removable polyurethane cushions. Muff Daddy is easy to clean and maintain. And this is supposed to be the result of September 11th. Another example, Britain's first licensed nude strip club, the Raymond Review Bar, today collapsed into administration after nearly half a century of trading. 9/11 and SARS have conspired to decimate takings. All right, so. There are many examples of this, of course, in the Private Eye, but I will not bore you with more of them. On a more serious note, Evan, maybe one thing which came to mind is why should, of course, you actually asked this question yourself. Why should the happenings of 9/11 change the way in which we or change theorizing in the social sciences? And of course, I think to answer that question, we have to look at the process of theorizing in the social sciences and the process of theorizing in knowledge in general. Now, in natural science, according to what some people call the positivist model, I think it's a general scientific model, actually, the empirical model of science, theory changes because empirical data are at some point fed into a hypothesis. So a theory generates a hypothesis, which generates experiments or whatever, and of course empirical data, the results of these experiments, feed into the theory and change it or fail to change it. And my question to you really is, first of all, is the process of theory building in the humanities different from this? I'm not sure it's different in the social sciences, for example, in anthropology. Certainly, although we do not talk in terms of hypothesis, theory, etc., if one looks at the history of anthropology, we have always used empirical data to change theory or to look at theory. I mean, it would be inconceivable in anthropology to revisit a theory without some empirical data. Now, of course, the model that you are using when designing your question, has September 11th changed, is this model, really, because September 11th is an empirical happening, which, of course, should feed back into theory and somehow change this theory. But my question is theory building in the humanities different And maybe this difference is the reason why September 11 has not changed, that is an empirical happening, has not changed theory building in the in the humanities.
I think it's a very trenchant question. Here by theory, I'm understanding the cumulative ideas of people like Lyotard, Derrida, Lacan, and so on and so forth. And in that field, there has always been a dogged resistance to the notion of a sudden rupture. One of the most basic questions which recurs in Lyotard's books is the banality of the question, is it happening? Is anything happening at all? A resistance to the notion then that the event, the absolute event, can happen. What is interesting, however, is that many theorists, in the way I'm using the word, seem to agree that September 11 is what they call a singular event. In Derrida's word, in Baradori's words, it is a species without genus. That means it is something which has happened uniquely and which cannot be contained within any understanding of any model we have. Now, what interested me is that normally Derrida would have given such an idea short shrift. The idea that September 11 is a unique event goes against everything that he has said in the past about notions concerning the difference between messianism and messianicity, and so on and so forth. And that is something I find almost perturbing, because it changes the whole tonality, the whole outlook, the whole perspectivality of theory. It's as if quite a few of them like to refer to the notion that the monstrous is not something made up of green beings with bulbous eyes and so on and so forth, but the monstrous is that which you can never predict. And the Oxford Literary Review number of 2001, ironically called Monstrism, dedicated a whole issue to that idea, but of course did not speak about September 11 because it couldn't. It had, you know, it came out before. Not sure if that answers your question, but
As I understand you, you're saying that according to these thinkers, September 11th is such a one-off that it cannot really fit into the category of empirical happening that should feed back into theory.
Yes, it is. It is a singular event which challenges the very practice of theorization, right? Almost.
I mean, I fail to see why it is such a singular event. But
yes, I myself am surprised. I myself am surprised. I would never have expected, definitely not Derrida, and possibly perhaps to a degree less. Well, I would have expected it more from Baudrillard and Žižek. But I have to say, I am surprised with this new tonality in theory.
If I were to take up and pursue this exchange between you and Mark one step further, and first of all, thank you for an extremely interesting analysis of how Derrida and others thought might have changed. I think what I would say is that you can distinguish within social theory between social science theory and obviously meta theory.
Yeah.
And I would always say that a whole range of social theorists from Marx onwards have been in concern with modeling the world and thus helping us to understand it. Such social theory is not disrupted or disturbed by September 11th. On the contrary, it is immensely excited. A whole new rich store of information now needs to be modeled. it is rather on the level of meta theory, where of course you have pinpointed the new disturbance in philosophy, or what you call the theory of the humanities. And here I suppose I'm referring to meta theorists from, in my own humble knowledge, Foucault onwards, who have really been more concerned about the conditions or criteria under which we discuss theory, that is to say, the conditions of discourse itself. And of course, there are theorists intermediate between these two levels of modeling. Clifford Geertsen, my own subject, anthropology comes to mind, who clearly is not just trying to model the world, but also try to understand how it is that we model the world. So your final conclusion, which draws on Derrida's recent work, would appear to be that it's very difficult to discuss the conditions under which discourse takes place, where discourse itself is denied, where, following Habermas, some of those who might engage that all discourse or communicative action assumes agreement of mutual perspective taking. Now here, not only is there no agreement to exchange perspectives, but you cannot even identify those who refuse to discourse with you, and they're not even identifiable. So it is in terms of this distinguish between ordinary social science theory and philosophical meta social theory that I begin to see, following Marx's question, why Derrida might be disturbed, philosophically disturbed.
In the field I suppose I'm coming from, there is this term which critics get highly excited about, a limit text. Now, a limit text would be that text which seems to be unavailable and unamenable to all the theories and modes of criticism which could be brought to bear on that text. It seems to collapse those models. And what I think is very interesting about September 11 is that it suddenly challenges people like Lyotard and Derrida and so on and so forth to, well, it challenges them with the prospect of something they cannot theorize away, something which is not, something which is effectively a limit text, if you like, to the ideas they might bring to bear. To me, what was, in trying to think through this paper, what was most profoundly shocking was to discover that Lyotard's Different is that which speaks about a precisely about the breakdown of discourse is actually not adequate to engage with the challenge which September 11 brings to theory, and that is why I indulged perhaps a bit too, you know, a bit too rhetorically, in the notion of the possibility that this is the worst of the times for theory.
Yes, sir. Comments, questions? Antoine, please.
Okay, I'm a layman because my specialty is agriculture and science, so I'm not familiar with all these authors. But it seems to me that most of them are not actually Americans, are they?
No.
What struck me was that they were so impressed by something that happened in the United States. And after all, terrorist attacks happened before 9/11, leaving a lot more victims. And for example, in Europe, there was the Chernobyl disaster, which was not a terrorist attack, but which, for a Frenchman, for example, could have been more traumatic because France had a lot of nuclear reactors. And therefore, there's always this danger of what cannot be predicted, but maybe an accident which could touch them more closely. So I think that they were impressed because of the media, actually. I mean, something also which struck me was that some of these authors, Baudrillard, for example, seemed astonished at the role of the media, as if he had discovered this role. and its importance of the image and the other. Well, this is a basic principle of media studies, that media create events. And therefore, I mean, they shouldn't be so surprised almost. I mean, I don't know why interpreted correctly this passage, but they seem almost surprised. Terrorists knew about media and planned everything that they brought in the media. And the fact that we are impressed by the terrorist attack in America is because we know the United States and we identify with them more than Burundi, for example, where there were a lot more things.
Yes, it reminds me of your question reminds me of a famous statement made immediately after September 11. We are all Americans now. It suddenly doesn't seem so apt somehow anymore. But the thing is that theory as a discipline, if we could call it that, has always had a very, very powerful Parisian axis. Most of the usual suspects, to use Habermas's phrase, in theory have in fact been European intellectuals who have then had, of course, a powerful impact in the United States and the humanities, and who have lectured there, been invited to give tours there, sometimes even sometimes in some cases even reside there now. There has been within theory in the US a powerful homegrown voice, and perhaps as a result of me having focused on Boradori's book and the books published by Verso, there was a bit of a distortion there. Perhaps I distorted the representativeness of what was said across different camps. But Chomsky did publish a book in the Verso series called 9/11, and Butler's book will come out in April. It's called Precarious Life, The Politics of Mourning and Violence. And I'm sure that when Butler's book comes out, incidentally the first one, knowing Butler, which will be written with a feminist take on the thing, I'm sure the tonality of the discussion will change.
The gentleman at the back, then Paul.
What really hit me was the discussion of the enormity of the unimaginable, the image, the symbolic image. And what it immediately reminded me of, and it really strikes at home, it's not in post September 11th movies and references to the World Trade Center, like the famous opening of Spike Lee's 25th Hour. September 11th. But what really strikes us home is the pre-September 11th science fiction movies. When we see a science fiction scenario, and you see, for example, the year 2025, and there's the American skyline, and the Twin Towers are there. And that really strikes home the enormity of how unimaginable the event itself was. Because even when you have a cinematic genre such as science fiction, in which the directors and the writers and whoever is producing it is trying to create the most imaginative and intelligently conceived picture of how the future will be, the Twin Towers are still there.
Yes.
For example, very close is, for example, artificial intelligence, which goes at the very ending of the movie 3,000 years into the future, and you see the Twin Towers frozen in ice. It goes, you know, 3,000 years into the future, and practically almost darkly comic, sarcastic, you can say, well, you got that one wrong.
Yes, yes. Reminds me of the ending of the first Planet of the Apes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes. It also reminds me of Independence Day, the film, in which the American president gives that pep talk before joining his fellow aviators then, and says, you know, we will not go quietly into the night, we will not vanish without a fight. It's
that's been voted the corniest
speech in the history of film. And it did have some competition, didn't it?
Paul and Adrian?
Two, you know, really simple questions. Have the theorists you're talking about somehow felt compelled to write about 9/11? That's my first question.
Yes.
And my second question, ironically, I have it at home, but haven't read it yet. But at the beginning, you explained very quickly why you left out Chomsky's book.
Mm.
And you said something like, it's not clear whether it's a book on, of theory or what kind of theory it is. Yeah. Whether it's
metaphysics,
can you just say something
about this? Yes. The first thing is really interesting, actually, because these Verso tries to give the impression that it was responsible for these books being written, whereas in some cases, some of the essays collected in, for example, Baudrillard's Spirit of Terrorism is made up of two essays. The second of the essays in the book is the transcript of an address which Baudrillard gave in an American university. Other essays in the books are transcribed articles, for example, from Le Monde. I think what has happened, however, if I were to be cynical, is not that the theorists felt compelled to write about September 11, but that others felt compelled to ask them what they felt about September 11. Because, of course, you want a philosopher somehow, you want somebody with the name Derrida, Habermas, and all that represents, to think September 11 for you. And it is a publicist's dream to come true. In everything, of course, always think of the dimension of the market.
And books are horribly expensive.
They are horribly expensive, and while the covers are nice, the rest of the production isn't actually very good.
£7 that thing.
Don't remember the price, but I remember, I think it was Maltese pounds. So the second question about Chomsky goes to the heart of an uneasiness which traverses my whole paper, and that is an issue about disciplinariness, because this is something which perhaps I can explain I'll come around to the Chomsky issue. But first let me refer to Borodora's book. She calls her book Philosophy in a Time of Terror. But of course there is a huge debate within philosophy about whether Habermas and Derrida can be classed as philosophers straightforwardly. Jacques Bouvres, for instance, who I think came over once to the Philosophy Society to give a talk, is quite adamant that Derrida should not be classified as a philosopher. And that is why I try to stress in my paper that perhaps it would be safer to speak about the theoretical humanities or about critical theory, although even critical theory is identifiable in two ways. The issue about Chomsky is one which is in a way more complicated. Chomsky is strangely omitted in discussions on theory, definitely in Britain, for instance. What is understood in Britain by theory, for some strange reason, does not include Chomsky, whereas it probably would. theory would probably include Chomsky in the US. The other thing is that Chomsky's views have been heard in the US with a bit of a populist streak. There was the famous debate with the arch conservative William Bennett on the US networks, and it somehow took the edge of the gravitas, if you like, of theoretical discourse. And then there is another thing: the form of the book is made up of really a series of sound bites, and it somehow accords oddly with the way in which theories attempt to write itself. But I myself, you know, I was about a bit uneasy about omitting Chomsky, but then I felt that I could probably get away with it.
My question draws on your answers to Antoine, this point about publicity, and also Adrian's question about Chomsky. I'm reminded of the debate mentioned by James Miller in his biography, The Life and Passions of Michel Foucault, in which the great French discursivist meets the great American anti-war protester.
Yes.
And Chomsky cannot understand easily where Foucault is coming from. And my understanding, limited though it is, of the description of that debate is something like this. Here is the playful, sophisticated discursivist playing with ways in which language is used. Perhaps, again, my humble opinion, the first genuinely original meta-theorist for many decades, because he breaks with Marx.
Yes.
And he says that
yes.
discourse is not based on society, but has a life and power of its own, which affects society. And there is Chomsky, rather like Bertrand Russell in an earlier generation, departing from theory, departing from philosophy, in a way turning his back on it and engaging directly in politics on grounds of right and wrong, however he chooses to define them. So that my question to you is this: could one not say that what the really quite identifiable terrorists, if you want to use that word terrorist, and I certainly would not ever use the word, I would call them freedom fighters. We're on radio, but I'm going to call them freedom fighters. Supposing these people have in fact épaté de bien pensant, what they've done is actually caught these chaps, the Parisian axis, as you call it, off guard. There is a whole class of social theory which sees discourse as rooted in real-life politics, in real-life real-life class conflicts, racial conflicts, or whatever. Whereas we have had, from Foucault onwards, in various inter-dialectical and conflicting manifestations, a whole attempt to charge discourse as having a life of its own.
Yeah.
And here, suddenly, our Parisians are caught with the fact that all these discursive formations are, in fact, based upon real-life problems.
Yes, yes. I think it would be impossible for me to answer that question without linking it again to Antoine's question, because there is a question of tonalities, definitely. It's a bit difficult to say quite what discipline you could place Foucault within, that you couldn't also place Chomsky within. But there is somehow a sense that they do not quite belong easily to the same discipline, however we would define this discipline. There is also a difference in their respective attitude to language. Foucault is not the most playful of the Parisian theorists, as it happens, and yet, compared with Chomsky, he comes across as profoundly playful, as someone who is ready to use language in productively ludic ways, which Chomsky would perhaps steer clear from, almost as if that is something in bad faith. And again, it reminds me of the chapter by Habermas in a book called Post-Metaphysical Thinking, if I remember well, in which he precisely takes issue with what he calls French theory because of its playfulness, because of its attempt to make theory like literature. And perhaps what we're looking at, perhaps what ultimately is happening in the kind of theory I am coming from, is the definitive placing into disrepute of what used to be called the linguistic turn, that everything can, that everything in the last instance is not in fact economic but linguistic. And I think this is probably a very interesting question, I think, would need to be looked at in those terms. There are national and disciplinary difference in the tonalities with which, you know, what we call theory is done.
I think we're time for a last question. Maybe a short question. Yes.
There's something I cannot quite come to terms with regard to terrorism and the future. So there is this new urgent tone. There is Derrida who's prepared to revisit his previous assertions on the apocalyptic, the messianic. There is this idea of a limit text, that September 11 is possibly a limit text. Yet there is Derrida's traumatism that's produced by the future, by the to come. What I cannot quite reconcile is Derrida's belief that Bin Laden, the Bin Laden model, has no future. Isn't that sort of underrating it?
Yes. To get to the point about the future first. at the moment, the question of the future of theory is a very powerful one. It's getting spoken of in practically all contexts that would call themselves meta-theory. Derrida has written about it. Jean-Michel Rabatte has devoted a book to it called The Future of Theory, which very interestingly does not refer at all to September 11. to the issue of whether Bin Laden has a future, and of course, you know, coming back to the question of, you know, Bin Laden within quotes, what he is referring to is not as such Bin Laden the man, but Bin Laden, if we like, the principle, which will survive independently of the man. in the sense of the Bin Laden effect, let's use it that way. I think the Bin Laden effect has a future in the sense that it's going, in the very simplistic sense, that it is obvious that it's going to be with us for some time. I think Derrida's point and the difficulty with it is that it's so it's said in a paragraph which is a bit too condensed, is that the Bin Laden effect opens onto no future because it is not entrenched in anything equivalent to the Western discourse of enlightenment. And this is the way with which, if I remember well, I might be wrong, but if I remember well, this is how, this is how Boradori opens the introduction to her book. One might wonder whether the discussion of 9/11 and global terrorism needs to reach as far as a critical reassessment of the political ideals of the Enlightenment. The thesis of this book is that it does. And my reading of Derrida's reaction to the Bin Laden effect is that he cannot see anything mildly analogous to the Enlightenment, which he himself would, of course, want to dissociate himself from, paradoxically. I think ultimately it's almost a crude point that what he's suggesting is that for Bin Laden to be against the West in general and what the West represents is, dare I use the word, almost puerile. looking at other things, he says, no, between the lines. Incidentally, this reminds me of a point I wanted to make. I think it was Gilbert Adair in his book The Postmodernist Always Rings Twice, who says that in this day and age we have plurals for every absolute and for every theory. So people speak about feminisms, post-colonialisms, deconstructions, theories, and so on and so forth. And he suggests that it is somewhat anomalous that people speak about the West, but never about the Wests. And if I wanted to try to come up with a defense of Derrida's statement, which would not be too simplistic, you know, that Bin Laden has no future, I think it would be this, that the Bin Laden position, let's call it that, one perhaps would hesitate to characterize it in that way, but the Bin Laden position against the West is perhaps lacking in its appreciation that there are Wests, perhaps rather than the West.
The thesis isn't
differentiated enough. Differentiating enough, I think.
And that West would be, of course, the Bali nightclub street.
Which is also a West.
Yeah.
Morocco. Which is also a West.
Morocco.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And of course, the French West is the very different from the American West, and so on.
Right. I think that's all I have time for. Thank you.
Thanks.
Dr. Bangalore, again. Thank you all for coming and making this work in progress seminar another success, I think.
And thanks for your questions.
You have listened to Work in Progress, a series of seminars on understanding cultural diversity.